So from last time, I showed how to bound the solution and the gradient, right? So for this we needed a structure condition that f of x z p is less than say z less than some n x and p in omega cross r n, and okay, we needed this sort of assumption. Well, these have to have, you know, this has to be G's in L1, omega H is L1 is locally, and non-negative. And for this, there was an assumption on the growth with respect to du. You don't have to write down the notes on the web, but all this. So with F, so once, assuming you've already bounded U, then the condition was F of X, Z, P is less than some constant, D to the beta, the distance, 1 plus P alpha, where alpha and beta bigger than or equal to 0, beta is bigger than alpha minus n minus 1. So basically, if the function grew too fast with respect to the gradient, you had to control that by putting in something that decays as you go to the boundary. L1, it's integrable. Locally, on compact substrate. So that's how far we got last time, and this was for omega, say uniformly convex. Okay? And I also mentioned last time that if there exists a convex function u bar, say, which is c2 in omega intersects c1 up to the boundary, and it's a subsolution and f is, say, non-decreasing with respect to this slot, then we have, by the comparison principle, u is between u underline, so it's a sub, and it's also lies below the harmonic function, where, so in that case, you get the bounds, these bounds automatically because, well, the picture's like this, is the harmonic function here is u, and here's u underline, and so you get u bounded between h and u underline, which is obvious, and the gradient is controlled at the boundary as well, and then because it's a convex function, the gradient of u is also controlled inside. So if you have this, you don't need any other assumptions. So the bounds that we've got so far, these two, are automatic. Okay, provided you have this subsolution. Okay, and the reason I'm pointing out that fact is today I want to do the second derivative bounds. And from now on, we don't need convexity anymore. Okay, so second derivative bounds. So let me go. So
let me first mention, if omega is, say, uniformly convex, but if omega is uniformly convex, then there exists convex, and it's a subsolution.
Okay, and what do you do? You take
to be function
phi, which, remember, I always assume phi is extended smoothly inside the domain, so this is makes sense. And then I add a large multiple of a uniformly convex defining function. So that mean? That means that omega is the set where, set psi is bigger than zero, and the gradient is not equal to zero on the boundary. So you, if the domain is uniformly convex, you can find such a psi that is also uniformly convex. So if you add a large enough multiple, you'll get something uniformly convex here, and in fact you can arrange that this is bigger than or equal to that in omega. Okay, because this, remember, is f of x u du, and we've bounded the solution, we've bounded the gradient, this is smooth, so this is bounded between two constants. So you can always find uniformly convex subsolution if you have a uniformly convex domain. Okay, so for Robert, who wasn't here last time I started talking about this Dirichlet problem, and I showed that everything here is smooth. I showed you get a bound for the solution if you have this sort of structure, which it's basically the same as the proof of the Alexandrov maximum principle. And I showed you get a gradient bound if you have this sort of assumption. So the function f can't grow too fast with respect to the gradient. If it does, you have to stick in an appropriate power of the distance to the boundary to control it. Okay. And the proof of that was by constructing a local barrier at the boundary. So okay, and in this box here, if you somehow can construct, or you assume there is, you have a subsolution of the problem, locally convex, then these bounds up here, the solution and gradient bounds, are trivial. Okay, so in any case, so whether you start in this setting and you've got a subsolution to begin with, or you get up to the C1 bounds and then you've got this bounded between two constants, and then you build the subsolution, if the domain is uniformly convex, there is always, what I'm going to talk about next, is we always assume there exists a subsolution. Okay, so from now on, we assume there is let's say locally convex sub u bar, which is say C2, with
Okay.
And I won't assume any convexity of the domain anymore. Yes. Well, basically, if you have then and if you change variables, this is the Jacobian, you get the integral over the gradient image of H. And if you have this strictly less than, it says that this gradient image is not all of Rn. And so the idea was, well, then there is something which is in the gradient outside the gradient image, and you have control on its slope. So the picture was then if you lift a plane with, say, P in Rn minus du, attached at the boundary rather than an interior point, and then whatever this slope was, u x is bigger than u of x0 minus p x minus x0, and you can control that measuring how big this difference is. If you have equality, then this argument doesn't give you a bound. You can take something as stretcher. Oh, you may still get a bound by some other means, sure. Right? A hemisphere, for example, doesn't satisfy this, but you do get a bound. Right? I mean, you can make other assumptions which will be... And this was just to get the gradient bound. Okay, so from now on, I'm going to talk about bounding the second derivatives, and okay, so okay, so we want to bound second derivative. So it breaks up into one, two, three, four steps. So first of all, there's the tangential second derivatives. This is on the boundary. Okay, so this is the easiest part. Suppose you have the domain. Let's take a point in here, and let's choose the coordinate. So that's the xn axis. This point is the origin, right? Which you can choose that at an arbitrary point on the boundary. So then everything is smooth. So near here, we can represent the boundary near it zero as omega, as xn is some function omega of x prime, where x prime is x1 up to xn minus 1. Okay, so locally we represent it as a graph in some neighborhood. So what do we know? Well, u is equal to phi on the boundary. So what does that mean? It means that u at x prime, omega x prime, is equal to phi x prime, omega x prime.
right? Because this is on the boundary, in the nearby here, right?
And so now we can differentiate this. So d omega at 0 is 0. Okay, so now we differentiate this, let's say, the x1 direction. What do we get? Well, you differentiate twice, and you evaluate it at x prime is equal to 0. Every time you get a gradient of omega, the thing's going to be 0. So maybe if I do it, so you get d1 u plus dn omega u, say d1 omega is same thing with phi, dn phi d1 omega. And when you evaluate that at, well, it's not evaluated yet, and then we differentiate once more. Well, you do it once more, and then you set x prime equal to 0, so anything that's multiplied by a gradient of omega is going to disappear. The only thing that's going to be left is at omega prime is equal to 0. Okay. Right, this anything when I differentiate this thing here and put x prime equal to 0, I'm going to get 0 stuff. So all the stuff that's multiplied by a gradient of omega disappears. So what's this telling us? It's telling us that at this boundary point, the d11u is equal to bounded stuff, because this depends only on the domain, this depends only on the boundary data, the same here, this depends on the boundary data and the domain, and the gradient of u we've already bounded. So except for this stuff here, everything else is under control. So which means that d11u at 0, well, actually I don't need absolute value signs, is less than some controlled constant. And of course it's a convex function, so it's certainly controlled from below by 0. So tangential second derivatives on the boundary are bounded, because there's nothing special about the E1 direction. I could take any tangential direction. It's the same argument. That's right. All the stuff. Okay, so we've got the tangential second derivatives bounded. Tau tangential to the boundary of omega at x. Okay, so you can do this at any point on the boundary, it's nothing special. Okay, so we've got that. Next, we want to bound the mixed normal second derivatives. Okay, so this is more complicated. So again, let me, I've got the domain here. Let's choose some point. Again, it can be coordinates chosen as before. And what we need is, what we want to do is differentiate the function u minus psi. See, it's always convenient to think of phi as being defined not just in on the boundary, but extended smoothly inside. We can do that. And I want to differentiate this in tangential directions, right? So one way to do that is to take extension of the normal vector field nu. So for example, you could define nu, let's say, usually take nu to be the outward normal, so we could take it to be minus the gradient of the distance. And that's a nice smooth function, so long as we stay close enough to the boundary. In fact, if the boundary is C2, then there's a small neighborhood, so that D is also C2 in that neighborhood. If it's C10, it's C10 in that neighborhood. So as long as it's C2 or better, it has the same regularity as the boundary. So as long as we stay close to the boundary, this gives us a nice extension of the normal vector field. And now we can look at this operator. Dk is dk minus nu k nu l dl. So it's just the tangential gradient. The tangential gradient operator. Right. So it just takes an ordinary gradient and it subtracts off the component, the normal component of that. And then you look at I don't have to call it anything. I look at this function, say for k 1 up to, say, n minus 1. So what this does, at this point, it simply agrees if k is less than n, right? And it gives me a way of extending to some neighborhood here, right? And what we have, delta k u minus phi is equal to 0 on the boundary of omega, because it's tangential everywhere on the boundary, and u is equal to phi on the boundary. Okay. That's right. They are. Exactly. And this is what I'm saying. That's all. That's exactly what that is saying. This one? Well, it agrees with the... Right. So, if I could maybe draw a picture, this... this is sort of... You know, it's derivative, which is always tangential, and I extend it inward. Now, inside, when I extend it, I can't say it's zero anymore, because it depends on which particular extension of phi I choose. Right? It's only zero on the boundary. Right? Because I can extend phi inside lots of different ways. So it's only true on the boundary. Okay, so if I can show, so what I want to show is that the normal derivative dn of delta k u minus phi, I want to show that that is bounded, say, at this point I'm working at. That's what I want to show. And then if I apply this to it for each k up from 1 up to n minus 1, I'll get the mixed tangential normal second derivatives bounded. Okay? Okay, is everyone happy up to here? That's what I want to show now. Here. Well, maybe. That's right. Yeah, yeah. That's why you have this equals zero. Right. But that's only on the boundary. Right? I can't assume that inside, only on the boundary. And so if I want to bound the mixed normal tangential, that is, if I get a bound like this, this thing then, apart from some correction terms possibly, this is just dnku minus. That's zero. And maybe there's some correction term. I guess there's a correction term possibly when you differentiate these, but it's a bounded thing, so it doesn't matter. Some new constant. Okay. So how do we do that? Okay, well, well, it's the barrier argument again. You see, we've got something equal to zero on the boundary. If we can show this function satisfies a reasonable differential inequality, then we can build a comparison function, an upper barrier, a lower barrier, and we'll get this then. Because if we can show that, we can find an upper barrier, a lower barrier, and it's somehow stuck in between, the normal derivative at the boundary is controlled. Right? So if I can find an upper barrier, a lower barrier, so that the picture looks like this, then I'll get that estimate. So to do that, I need to show, first of all, that this satisfies a reasonable differential inequality. Yes, I'm considering this function here. Right, let's call it, say, z. And I want to construct an upper barrier and a lower barrier. Same sort of thing as we had last week for the gradient bound. Or if we have here, you've got upper barrier here, that's a harmonic function. Got a lower barrier here, the subsolution, or if I use this structure condition, I constructed explicitly a lower barrier at the boundary. And we do exactly the same thing here. So to do that, we need to know that this satisfies a reasonable differential inequality. And when you look at this for a while, you see what's going to be in there. Well, basically, you're going to get, well, let's just do it, okay? You've got f, so I write the equation f v2u is log determinant v2u is, say, g xu du, where g is log f. And if I differentiate this, I get fij dij ku is equal to g p I d I k u plus g z d I d say k u plus g x k. Okay, so what do we get here? Well, dij of z, we're going to get dk dij k u minus phi, and then we're going to get dijl u minus phi. Then we're going to get some cross terms. Okay, so now let's hit that with Fij. What do we get? Well, here we can replace Fij dijku with this thing. It all out, but we can replace this, goes in there once it gets hit by Fij. Then what else have we got left? Same sort of thing here. What we end up, well, we'll get delta k g x k plus GZ D K how do I write this? Okay, so you use this in here, you will get okay, you're going to get okay, these third derivatives are going to disappear using this, and you'll get a term like this. And the rest is all bounded stuff, okay? So this is the terms of interest. And then you get a similar thing here, third derivatives of u, Fij, Gij, Lu. You use the same thing, and you get that again. So if you look at what the first derivatives of z are, it's... I don't want to write it all out because it's painful. But it's clear, right? The third derivatives of u, you use this to replace. That gives you some stuff involving second derivatives. And all that stuff involving second derivatives can be put into this, right? Because it's always going to be multiplied by a GPI. And you may get some correction term, which is bounded, right? Yeah, there's other second derivatives. Then, what else? So that gives us this term. Then we have stuff involving other second derivatives. Now these terms, they all look like this. It's Fij times DJL of u, right? And this, remember, is the inverse matrix. And so we're multiplying U upper ij by djl. That gives us a delta il. So these second derivative terms, when you hit them with the fij, they actually just disappear because it's the inverse matrix. Because I wrote it in this form, log determinant. I don't need to write it in that form. I could work just with determinant. Then you get delta ij times some f or something. Right, it's just... Right, it's a determinant. It's a special property. Well, it's a special property of the determinant that they cancel out nicely like this. In general, you have to do this a little more carefully, but it's the same idea. Okay, so these second derivative terms that come here, because they get hit by Fij, we just get delta ij, so they're bounded. And everything else that's derivatives of the normal, second derivatives of, and stuff like that, second derivatives of the normal, and so on. This should be a DL here. Okay? So we get a whole lot of bounded stuff, so let me just say O of 1. What else is left? The other second derivatives have gone into here. And what's left is stuff Fij times just bounded stuff, say third derivatives of psi, second derivatives of phi, second derivatives of the normal multiplied by bounded stuff. So you get stuff that looks like Fij times some bounded matrix. So in other words, it's controlled by the trace, where trace is just that. So the conclusion is that this L of Z is controlled by constant 1 plus trace. Okay? Which is not a bad differential inequality, right? It's quite nice. Something linear, controlled by constant 1 plus trace. Where this constant really depends on bounds for the solution and its gradient. It depends on phi up to its third derivatives. It depends on derivatives of the normal vector field up to order 2. So it depends on the C3 regularity of the boundary. Okay, but all that goes into this constant. Okay? Well, if I have Fij and it's hitting some bounded matrix Bj, Bij, and this is bounded, this whole thing is controlled by some constant times the trace. It's a positive definite matrix. So it doesn't matter what this is, it's a bounded thing. So you just get, you estimate it by the trace. Yes? Well, I chose this one because I get the inverse matrix. If I chose just that, then Fij would be the cofactor matrix, which is the inverse matrix times the determinant, so it would be time F times that. Well, you know, I mean, this is still bounded between two positive constants, so it's not going to change anything. It's just whatever you prefer to. Or you could choose something else. Nth root of the determinant, another reasonable choice. I mean, it doesn't matter what you're going to take. You're never going to get something significantly different. You know, you're not going to get a better differential inequality just by rewriting the equation in a different way. Okay, so we've got this nice differential inequality. We've got z is equal to 0 on the boundary. In fact, technically, this is, since I chose an extension that's really only defined in a neighborhood, this is near 0. Yes. Well, third derivatives of u disappear from this, right?
Sure. That's the same thing. So the left hand side, LZ.
The left hand.
Oh, yeah. You're saying it's not really third derivative because the third derivative
is involved here. I mean, this is just an expression, right? And I've estimated what you get. Okay, so I've got a linear differential inequality. The coefficients, of course, they depend on the second derivatives, and here on the x, u, du, but this is already bounded. This is not bounded yet, but we know something about the structure. It's the inverse of this, and the determinant is bounded between two constants. We're going to use those facts, right? Okay, so we've got a reasonable differential inequality, we've got a nice boundary condition, now we have to construct a barrier. So, make sure I get this. Okay, so first of all, let me write that. We have this function d2u underline is bigger than some epsilon times the identity matrix, right? It's uniformly convex. Okay, because, it's c2, we're assuming we have it's a subsolution, so its determinant is strictly positive, so it must also be bounded from below. If it's bounded above. Okay, so we've got that, and now we construct the barrier. So the barrier is going to be a function w. It's going to be u minus the subsolution plus some constant theta times h minus u underline minus another constant n times the distance squared to the boundary. And this is going to be in omega delta, which is omega intersect b delta 0. So we need to choose theta and delta positive and small, and we need to choose n positive large. I'll say what h is. H is the harmonic function with h equal to phi on the boundary. Okay. So I build this barrier using the subsolution, a supersolution, a harmonic function, right, and something that depends on distance from the boundary. So the lemma is that for n sufficiently large and theta and delta sufficiently small, L of W is less than minus epsilon over 4, where epsilon is this epsilon here, 1 plus the trace. And that's true in omega delta. And W is bigger than or equal to 0 on the boundary of omega delta. Okay. So we're heading in the right direction, right? We've got, this is going to be, well, you see, we're getting the right sort of differential inequality. You can see here we've got some small constant, then we've got a big one, so you can see eventually we're going to take a large multiple of this to build the barrier. Okay, so now, how do we prove that? I guess this can go. So we look at the different pieces. So Fij Dij of U minus U bar. Well, Fij is the inverse matrix. Hitting Dij, U, gives us the identity matrix. We take the trace of that, we get N. And then here we get Fij times Dij U bar, U underline, well, eigenvalues are bounded from below. So from below, that is bounded by epsilon times the trace, and there's a minus, so it's minus epsilon times the trace, and it goes that way. Therefore, L of U minus U bar, well, remember this is just Fij Dij U minus U minus GP I Di. Well, we're going to have N, well, minus, we're going to get N, and then here, well, all this stuff is just bounded. First derivatives of U are bounded, so you just get some constant minus epsilon times the trace. Okay, next we look at we've got one part. Next we look at Laplacian. Remember, U is convex, the eigenvalue is bounded from below by epsilon, so Laplacian is bigger than N epsilon. Okay, so if we take, say, sigma psi plus or minus, I can't remember, it doesn't matter, and we take the convex, a convex defining function, it needn't be convex, we take just a defining function, then for sigma small, this will still be, say, bigger than or equal to zero. And remember, is equal to phi on the boundary. And the harmonic function, h is also equal to phi on the boundary. And therefore, this must be less than the harmonic function inside. So, H minus U bar
is bigger than or equal to, I guess I want the minus sign, say, plus or minus sigma psi. Psi is small. And this, by taking, so I take the plus sign, now that I know what I want, times the distance function, right? So because I've got this bigger than some positive number, the harmonic function is zero, I can squeeze in a little bit in between and still get a differential inequality. So that I can compare them. And that gives me this. I squeeze so that H minus the subsolution is not just bigger than or equal to zero, but bigger than some constant times the distance. It's a function which is where such that omega is the set where it's positive and the gradient is not zero on the boundary. So. So that would be omega. Because the gradient is not zero on the boundary, I can estimate this by the distance.
Didn't you say that we're not doing that?
Well, you always have a defining function for a domain.
Okay.
I'm not assuming convexity anymore. I haven't used convexity here. I'm just doing a comparison argument, right? I squeeze, since I have a strict inequality here with a positive constant, I can put in a small multiple of the defining function. I still get bigger than or equal to here, so I can compare it with the harmonic function, and then I get this, and I estimate psi from below by some multiple of the distance function, right? And because the gradient is not zero, that's okay. I can do that. Okay. And if I work out L of H minus U bar, well, these are nice functions which are bounded. The derivatives are bounded. This is smooth. This has derivatives at least. Second derivative's bounded. So when I hit it with the Fij, I'll just get Fij times bounded stuff, so we can control that by some constant times the trace. And then the GpiDi will give me just a constant. So that's true. Two norms are bound by something. Okay, so now we put it all together. Okay, we're heading for this sort of inequality here. So we put all this together. So we get L of W is less than C0 plus theta C1 plus theta C1 minus epsilon times trace. And then we've got the stuff that comes from the distance squared. So we get minus 2n, and then it's
going to be D times L of D plus Fij Did Dj D. Okay, again, L of D, again, D if you make delta small, depending only on the domain. So this part here is going to give us minus 2n D, let's call this C. Actually, the other way. It's true both ways, but it doesn't matter. We want the lower bound. Well, I guess there's a minus there. And then we've got this term here. So this is going to be a good term. It's going to give us something to control the other stuff. Okay, well, what do we know? Remember the distance function, because xn is the normal here, but okay, and d is a nice smooth function. So if we stay in a ball near here, this is not going to change very much. In fact, Fij Di D D J D is going to be bigger than or equal to F N N D N is a half, and then the other stuff that we get plus 2 alpha less than N F alpha N D alpha D D N D is the other stuff that's left, and we throw away. This is bigger than or equal to zero. And throw that away. If we estimate, this is just one half F, no half here. But if we stay near in a ball of radius delta, then this is going to be, say, at least one half, or at least, I don't know, one minus something, something small. So we'll get, say, one half Fn here. The other stuff we will get, because we've always got this, if this is sort of Dn, D is going to be like 1 minus delta. The tangential parts are going to be like delta. This is in omega delta. So we'll get, say, 1. If delta is small, we'll get, say, 1 half there. Then here we're going to pick up a factor delta, or constant delta, and we just estimate this by the trace. Minus some constant C3 delta times the trace. Actually, there's a constant there. Right. This is a function which is 1 at the origin, and it's a smooth function. So if I stay within delta of the origin, this will still be 1 minus some constant delta. And this is 0 at the origin, therefore
It's going to be of order constant delta. Right?
So if delta is small, this is like 1 minus constant delta squared. Delta is small, I can make that bigger than a half. Right? And the other stuff here, I estimate this by the trace. This gives me constant times delta. And this is just bounded by 1. So I just get this. Okay, so what happens now? So now, what we're going to get here then is this gets multiplied by n. So what we're going to get is, if I just sort of erase this, get a minus n fn n minus c3 delta times the trace. Maybe there's a 2 there, it's not. Plus, yes. And there's an n there. Something like this. Okay, so now you see theta small is going to be good. This term's going to control that term. Then here, this term is going to be good once n is large. Then if we make d small, this is going to be order delta. So the delta here then. And that's also going to be absorbed into here by making delta small once n is fixed. And here we've also got a delta. This should be 1 plus trace. Delta, which, so basically this term here is the same sort of thing as there. Right? So we've got this minus epsilon trace, which is a good term, and that, which is a good term. Now everything else is going to behave, provided we can get a good bound here. We have to show that this term gives something good. Okay, so how do we do that? So we let lambda 1 up to, say, lambda n be the eigenvalues of b2u. So the trace, remember, is sum fii, which is sum of the u upper i's, the inverse. So it's the reciprocals of the lambdas. And we order these so that they go this way, actually. Lambda n is the biggest, so then dn nu is bigger than or equal to lambda n this is not right, it should be fnn, I have to correct that, is bigger than lambda n inverse, right? Because lambda n is the biggest eigenvalue, therefore 1 over lambda n is going to be the smallest eigenvalue of the inverse matrix. Right? So now we have epsilon over 4 times fii plus n fnn is bigger than or equal to, we use the arithmetic geometric mean inequality. So we get n times epsilon over 4. And then we take this. So we get n epsilon n to the 1 over n. And then we've got the product of the lambdas. Well, product of the lambdas is just the determinant. It's just f, which is bounded above and below. So this is bounded by some constant. Okay? So let's call it C1. Okay, so now we've got this is going to give us, for n large, this is giving us a big negative constant here, which is going to control all the constant terms. Right? So you get the picture now? Putting it together. All right. Okay, so this term here now is C1 in nth root. Okay? So now, you see, you've got this minus epsilon. So you can see now, if you fix, first of all, theta small, so that this is, say, less than... you want this, say, less than epsilon over 4, say, then you've got some stuff here, but it gets multiplied by deltas. You fix for delta... Then you fix... So we fix... let's see... theta C1 less than epsilon over 4. Right, we can make it equal to, say, then we fix n so that C1 n to the 1 over n is bigger than all these constants we have, C1, C0, plus epsilon. I'm not sure if all these numbers are, the way I've written them, are quite right, actually. I have to check. But anyway, the idea is clear, right? Theta and delta small are going to be controlled by this, the trace terms. And the constant terms to the left are going to be controlled by this, by making n large. So choose... so this is true. I'm not sure that's right, but I'll check this. C2 plus C3 n delta less than epsilon over 4. And then we fix delta so that this is true. So first fix theta, then fix n, then fix delta. L of W is less than minus epsilon over 4, 1 plus trace in omega delta. Okay, so we get the first inequality here. And to get the second one, we have to look at what happens on the... boundary omega intersect B delta. What do we have? We have W U minus U bar plus H minus U bar is a theta minus N D squared. Well, U minus U bar is this is bigger than or equal to zero. We throw that away. Here we have a theta. Then, remember, somewhere. Where was it? Here. We managed to squeeze out this C0 delta. So here we have H minus U bars bigger than C0 D minus N D squared, which is theta C0 minus N D times D. And if we fix delta even smaller, if necessary, right? Because the delta is chosen after we fix n, so it's chosen so this is true and so that this is bigger than or equal to zero, then we get that this is bigger than or equal to zero, right? If delta is also n delta is less than theta C0. So we get that as well. So we've got this. Okay, and now the barrier is pretty easy. You look at L A W plus B mod X squared plus or minus delta K U minus phi. Okay, so that's the barrier you use now. A large where A is much, much bigger than B, bigger than 1. So you choose B first. So the picture is like this. This is B delta. You know, this is zero on the boundary here, and W is positive or non-negative everywhere on the boundary. So on here, you have, on this part here, this function here is bigger than or equal to zero. You need to add on this thing here because you want to make on here you want a W plus B delta squared plus or minus delta K U minus phi to be bigger than zero on this part here. So that's why you add on a big B. So now you fix B large so that this is true. This is some bounded thing. So B delta has to be bigger than the absolute value of this. This is always positive. So you fix B, and then you choose a W so that A large so that you just get an A here. So you get the differential inequality. It's less than or equal to. Right. And then you look at this. By the comparison principle implies that A W plus B X squared plus or minus delta K U minus phi is less than or equal to zero in omega delta. Now, by the comparison principle. And you see, you have equality here at X zero. This is W is 0 at x0, this is 0, this is 0 on the boundary. Equality at 0. And therefore the normal derivative, if it's the picture is this, this should be the other way. Picture is this, it's 0, it's positive inside, or at least non-negative. The normal derivative, the inward normal, must be positive. Dn A W plus B X squared
Russell minus delta K U minus phi at 0 must be bigger than or equal to 0. That's right. You have an upper and a lower bound, right? That gives you the estimate we wanted. That sorry? Well, yeah, yeah. Right. So you've got a bound on the normal derivative of this, or on the. A bound on the normal derivative of this thing gives you a bound on dKnu from above and below, right? So that's the argument. Do you need a break, or do I just continue? Oh, yes, there's more. Okay, I mean, I don't mind. Yes, all right. Yes.
So you have three more lectures to be
done. Oh yeah. 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 Three more is fine.
So in Greg said he someone wanted to talk to me yesterday, so he had a week to do the argument because he wanted to talk about the piece of alpha W.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, yes, they are. Yeah.
Will that overlap with anything?
No, that won't overlap. No.
Great. So, and the only question is which
day? I don't mind. I'll be here. Except for next week, I'll be here all the time, so it doesn't matter.
So, Greg's preference is to speak on either December 4th or December 11th?
Yes, he can choose whichever one he wants.
So you're December 4th, and I know I'm going to be a little bit late on December 11th.
Okay.
Classes actually end this week, but
yeah, that's okay. I don't mind.
And I'll give two more lectures also, and I will give you student presentations on the 9th.
On the 9th? Okay, so I'll be here back for that too. And that's part of their assessment.
Yeah.
Has anyone chosen to talk about PDE rather than optimal transport? Probably not.
First of all, there are so one guy is doing, they both want to do economics.
I see.
So I gave one of them a little problem, and I don't know what if you can do something with duality, and I don't know what people do with it. The problem is carrying, you have a bunch of employees, maybe they're going to continue with employees with different skill levels.
Mm-hmm.
And you're asked to divide them into two groups, managers and assistants,
yes.
And then pair them. Such that the productivity of the group is the product of the manager's skill level squared times the assistant's skill level, and you want to maximize the sum of their group productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is renaming echelon, probably a Cameron city.
I see.
Well, I don't know. I want to summarize what's in the inspiration, particularly Savari book about
yes, I have. Yes. I can tell. I can tell you why it works, if you like.
It's actually better than
Yes. Yes, because that gives you.
you get interior estimate, second derivative bounds without any assumption. That's right.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it is just sort of solving the Dirichlet problem, approximation, so on. But I think it still includes some interesting cost functions. Okay, so, no, we're not finished yet. So, what we've got so far, we've bounded the this part, the tangential, and the mixed tangential normal, but we still have to get the double normal on the still there, yes, there's still, yes, I'm not going to get through all that today, so. Yes, that's exactly. Okay, so the equation, well, so let's write the equation at the origin. We can assume that this part is diagonal, right? You can always rotate the tangential directions to diagonalize. So what we get from the equation is dn in u times the product, this is all at, well, plus, when you do a an expansion of the determinant, then write this down, say the last row, or last row or last column, doesn't matter. What you get is this part, and then you get a bunch of other stuff, and this just depends on second derivatives ij, where I plus j is less than 2n. Is equal to f. Yes. Okay. Okay, so at the origin, we expand this out. This is bounded because we've bounded all the stuff circled in pink. And f is bounded. So, is bounded provided provided this is bigger than some positive constant. Then we can solve. So, the estimate we need to do this is really, we need to show this. Okay? So how are we going to do that? So we show, actually I don't show that, I show d alpha alpha u 0 is bigger than some c 0. Okay, so let's look at this again. So let's look at this quantity sigma. We look at second derivatives in direction psi, and we look at the point where x is on the boundary, psi is tangential the boundary, length 1. Okay? We look at this quantity and we want to... No, not inf. Not super, the minimum. And we want to get a bound for that. Right? So, suppose d11u0 is equal to sigma. So, this minimum has to be attained somewhere. So, we choose coordinates in the usual way. It's attained here. It's
is E, the x1 direction, this is xn, right?
So what do we have?
So we let so here, as you, before, we can represent xn is equal to omega x prime near 0. So as before, what we have is that d11 u bar 0 minus d11 u at 0 plus dn u bar minus u d11 omega 0 is equal to 0, because u bar minus u x prime omega x prime is equal to 0. So by differentiating twice, and in fact, for any tangential vector field, say tau, on the boundary, we have, by the same computation, minus, now I take the outward normal, so the sign changes, and this is the normal curvature of boundary omega. This is for x in the boundary. So the normal curvature, this is kappa 1. If you take different tangential vector field, you just get the normal curvature corresponding to the tangential direction, alpha. So what do we know? So let's take, so we take unit vector field, tau, with tau equal to the E1 direction at 0. Okay, so I don't need to extend it to the whole boundary. I'm working just in some neighborhood, so I can always assume it's the unit vector field. So what do we have? D tau tau u restricted to boundary omega, say intersect B delta 0, has a minimum at 0. This function has a minimum. Right, I'm thinking of the vector field now sort of defined. It varies up here somewhere. But it has, this quantity has a minimum. It's a unit tangential vector field. It agrees with E1 at 0. And that's where the minimum is attained. So this function has its a minimum there. I'm just going to prove some lower bound. Sigma is the minimum value. It's attained. I'm chosen coordinates, so it's attained in this specific configuration. Right? And so this function now has a minimum at that point. Okay, and now we look at this formula here. Another way to say that this has a minimum is to say that whatever that's equal to has a minimum. So,
This is the outer normal derivative.
The nu is.
Yeah, I've chosen the outward normal so that n has become, this is that's where the minus sign has appeared there.
Okay.
I know it's a bit confusing.
It's basically the same.
It's the same. It's the same, exactly the same. Right. So when we say this thing has a minimum, or in other words, this minus this has a minimum at zero. It's another way, since that's equal to this minus that, this min, or if you rearrange it, k tau x d nu u bar minus u x is less than or equal to d tau u bar x minus d tau u zero plus kappa tau zero d nu u bar minus u zero. This is for all x on the boundary intersect b delta zero. Now, let's suppose that d 1 1 u at zero is less than a half. Less than a half d 1 1 u bar at zero. If not, then okay, and then if it's not, then we've got the lower bound that we want. It's just a half epsilon, where epsilon is the minimum eigenvalue. This? Well, you see, this function has its minimum. So another way to say that is, because that's equal to this minus that, that this function that's in the blue stuff also has its minimum at zero. And if you rearrange that, that means that if I take what have I done? Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
I think so.
So we're in the middle of the test how to use it. What's going on with U bar?
Yeah, what's going on with U bar? Okay, well, all this stuff here. Here. That should be a U bar of zero. Probably that's correct. Yes, that should be a U bar, Yes. Okay, I have to fix that up. Okay, so we have that. Now, let's suppose that we have this inequality, because if not, we already have the estimate we want, right? This? Okay, this function has its minimum at zero. And that function is equal to the stuff in the blue from this equality. Right, you take this to the other side. Right? That translates to this. Now, if we come back to here, d nu u bar minus u kappa tau is d11 u bar minus d11 u. This is at zero, which is bigger than or equal to 1/2. So what do we see from that? Well, this quantity here, remember u but underline lies below, so this thing here is bigger, this is bigger than or equal to zero, and it's a bounded thing. So this is positive, this is positive, and this is bounded. That means, well, if it's bounded by some constant, right? Means that kappa tau at zero is bigger than or equal to epsilon over 2 times c. So that's bounded below. The epsilon... Well, this is just this part. So we're assuming we have this inequality, so this is bigger than that. Otherwise, we have the lower bound immediately. Okay. So we may as well assume it's less than 1/2. Then what do we have when we write out this? If you write it out, we get this. So this right-hand side, this is positive. So this has to be positive. Now this thing here is positive, and it's bounded from above. So we can, so that means that this is also positive, and it must be bounded from below. And therefore, we can assume that k tau for x is bigger than or equal to, if we stay in the delta ball, say 4 over c. And okay, so first of all, we do it on the boundary, and then we are free to extend it inwards. So, right, it's... here it's bigger than epsilon over 2c, so if I take delta small on here, it's bigger than, say, epsilon over 4c, and then I can extend that function in some way, smooth way inside, so it's, say, bigger than, say, 8c inside, right? So what do we have? divide by this, put this over here, and we call this, all of this stuff, psi of x, right? Depends on the subsolution, it depends on and this function psi, everything else is just constant. And this function depends just on the boundary. Right. So what we have, d nu u bar minus u is less than psi, or capital, let's call this a capital psi, of x in the boundary of omega intersect b delta. And we have equality at the zero. Okay, so again, we're getting into the setup where we can use a comparison argument. Okay, so let me write capital Phi is Psi minus d nu u bar minus u. So that's bigger than or equal to zero with zero at. And now we compute a differential inequality. Well, L. Okay, so what have we got? We've got a function here that depends on x. That's a nice smooth function. Depends on, you know, second derivatives of the subsolution. I have a feeling we might need subsolution to be C4 here. Anyway, I'll check. We have something nice and smooth here. So you can compute. From the first part, you're just going to get trace terms. And the second part, well, again, it's something nice. Here. And then we've got third derivatives of u. Remember, third derivative, when we differentiate this twice, third derivatives don't harm us because they always come in this sort of way. And that's just the once differentiated equation. So we end up with this inequality. It's exactly the same argument as before. Right? Same sort of computation. And now we use same comparison argument as before. Exactly the same as before. We get d nu at zero is less than or equal to zero, and if you rewrite what that means, you look at what the definition of psi is, or phi. You find that you rearrange all that. Well, this is all going to give you bounded stuff. Most of the stuff's going to be bounded there. What you will get is a double normal derivative of u coming in. And when you clean it all up, what you have is dnnu. But zero is bounded by a constant. Right? You get a whole lot of. When you compute this, you get a bunch of terms, right? Most of them are just bounded. And then one of the terms comes from differentiating here d, double normal derivative of the normal derivative of u, which gives you dnn, or d nu nu. And everything else is bounded. It goes into the constant. So what have we got? at this point, zero, what have we got? Well, we've got where at the point where this minimum is attained, we have the double normal second derivative bounded, right? And we also know that all the stuff up here and the mixed tangential normals were also bounded. So the full second derivative is bounded.
The full Hessian is bounded. That point.
And if the full Hessian is bounded and its determinant bounded below by some positive thing, then it must also be bounded from below. Okay. The point is,
we use that as an estimate of CNNU 0 to get it our hands of that estimate. Could we have estimated CNNU and X directly without going through this estimate of the minimum of D alpha alpha?
Well, you see, you want to solve from the equation for this, right? So you need to get a lower bound for this, and that's what this argument gives you. Yes, but hang on. But this bound here, I proved this bound. Remember, I mean, I've been a bit careless here, saying, well, let's choose the coordinates that are the origin and so on. That bound, DNNU at zero bounded, is true only at the point where this minimum is attained. Only there, not anywhere else. It's true at this point where the minimum is attained. Therefore, at that point, I have all the second derivatives bounded, and therefore I have a lower bound at that point. Therefore, at that point, I can solve. At the point where the minimum is attained, I have a lower bound. Since that's where the minimum is, I have the lower bound everywhere. And then I can solve from the equation. Okay. Okay, where did the normal derivative... Okay, we did this argument, the comparison, which gave us this. Right? And then you work out what that is, you get a bunch of crap, and you get one term which involves normal derivative of nu, and the normal derivative of the normal derivative gives you a d nu nu u, or dnn u. Right? And that's estimated by all the leftover stuff, which is just bounded by a constant. Yes. Yes.
Okay. So, in particular, it also tells me that D alpha alpha u be greater than some small positive number for any point on the bound.
Yes, I've got the bound for that where the minimum is attained, right? Right, I've chosen this is the minimum over the whole boundary and over all tangential directions, so I suppose that has to occur somewhere. So let's suppose it occurs in the E1 direction at a point which we can fix to be the origin. Well, it's a convex function, remember?
Right.
All the pure second derivatives are non-negative, at least.
But the boundary need not be convex.
Doesn't matter. The function, the boundary needn't be convex, right? But the function is always has positive Hessian. So if you're in a neighborhood, it's always. Yeah. It's a Euclidean. So it may not be globally convex in this case, right? It may be. So anyway, that's the boundary second derivative estimate. The next thing, which I won't do today, I'll let you go home, is to show that once you've got it bound on the boundary, then it's bounded on the interior. And that's basically a maximum principle for the second derivative. That's somewhat easier.
Middle
blackboard.
Yeah.
So this is the function psi. I add on exactly the same things here. I use exactly the same comparison barrier function here. I add on a large multiple of x squared. If you think about this, I'm exactly in the same situation as I was before when I had the when I had these things. They satisfy the same sort of inequality.
Okay, and now phi of x is psi of x minus d mu of u of x, right?
Yeah.
Up there. Whereas on this left hand bottom board, you've got d mu as u of 0. You're not getting your d mu.
It's here. Sorry, that's at 0 from here. Right, this the function I look at, I wrote it somewhere, it's psi, which is all of this, minus this stuff here.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Can you double
this from here? Yes, from here. So I get, that's minus minus, so I get d nu u is bounded by all the other stuff, which gives you this. Yeah. Okay. This last step, by the way, this is not the way it was originally done. This was a modification that Trudinger came up with for Hessian equations. The original proof required the same sort of thing to get a lower bound because you solve from the equation, but it was a different argument. It was, well, probably about as complicated, or probably more. For the Monge-Ampere equation, it's probably about the same, but for other equations, Trudinger's argument works a bit better.